The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finn, and we've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, this is something special. We're going to be interviewing Randall Schoenberg, who is the attorney who has helped was responsible for the return of the famous Klimt painting of Adele Bloch Bauer to its rightful owner. It's been held for almost 60 years by the Austrian government prior to, actually before World War II. Even it was confiscated and now hangs in the Neue Museum and is the subject of a film which is out and about called The Lady in Gold. We have a cappella music because we're in the weeks of Sefira between Passover and Shavuos, and sometime in between the weeks of Passover and Shavuos, we'll explain why again we are playing a cappella music. We've been doing it again for 19 years. We're doing this. So we have a wonderful assortment of a cappella music. The portion of the week is the portion of Shmini, and we are going to be closing with an awesome Hasidic story. You'll stay all the way to the end, I'm sure. But before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. An unnamed Israeli tourist was killed in central Berlin while on his way to a Seder at the local Chabad house. Passersby found the 22-year-old in an alley off the central square. He was killed by blunt trauma to the head. That's all we know. Two IDF soldiers were wounded, one seriously, in a terrorist attack outside the West Bank town of Sinji. The terrorist was shot and killed by one of the injured soldiers. Two people died and 24 were injured at the funeral of Rabbi Shmuel Vosner. More than 100,000 people attended the funeral. The area of the funeral was too small for the crowd, and the crush of the crowd caused the injuries to the people. The body of a 4-year-old hiker was pulled from a ravine in the Judean hills after the man fell from a 150-foot cliff. It is unclear why he fell. Nearly 60,000 tourists visit Israel's national parks each day during this holiday season. Related news. Unfortunately, a 22-year-old Israeli hiker fell to his death in Peru, and a 12-year-old Israeli girl died when the ferry she was riding caught on fire. And this week's acts of anti-Semitism in the U.S., this week we only have one, thank you, Shari Torah Synagogue in Gaithersburg, Maryland, was spray-painted with swastikas and other racist graffiti. Police have launched an investigation. And some sport news. We've got two sports pieces for you to round out the news. The Palestinian authorities claim to FIFA, the International Soccer League, to ban Israel from international play was denied. The PA maintained that Israel is racist to Arabs, but the FIFA people said, yeah, okay, so what? That's not what they said, actually, but they just said, we're not excluding Israel because that would be bad for the game. And finally, the first ever biblical marathon was run this week. The Bible Marathon relives the story of an Israelite man from the tribe of Benjamin who escaped a disastrous battle with the Philistines and sprinted all the way to Shiloh, which was the capital of Israel at the time, to break the news of the death of the sons of Eli, the high priest, as mentioned in the book of Samuel. So instead of reenacting a run from Athens to Marathon, they're running to Shiloh. I don't know where it started, somewhere in Benjamin, somewhere. And that's the news.
Hi, everybody. This is a special weekend for Americans across the country and people around the world. It's a chance to spend time with family, to celebrate miracles from days gone by, and to reflect on the blessings God has granted us in our lives. On Friday night, I hosted a Passover Seder at the White House. Michelle and I joined Jewish families in America, Israel, and around the world as we retold the story of an awesome God who liberated a nation with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and set them on their journey towards the Promised Land. It's a tale that has been passed down from generation to generation, and it's given strength and courage to countless men and women over the years from Jews facing anti-Semitism to the brave young civil rights leaders who led our own country's march towards justice and equality. Whether faith in God shapes our daily lives completely or not at all, we believe that with common effort and shared sacrifice, a brighter future is just around the bend.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Hey, Schulteman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We have on the line Mr. Randall Schoenberg, who is the principal attorney in the fight for the return of the famous Klimt painting Adele Blochbauer to its rightful owner. We have to turn that into a shorter title somehow, but we will during the course of the day. How are you today, Mr. Schoenberg?
I'm fine. You just call it like the movie does, Woman in Gold.
Okay, fair enough. Indeed. Can we call you Randy?
Sure, everybody does.
Okay, that's awesome. Thank you so much. Okay, now, the Jewish Hour has been on air since 1996, and we report the news every week. And in 1998, I was jumping up and down when I saw that the Austrian government was willing to start returning paintings and other artifacts that had been confiscated illegally confiscated during the Nazi occupation or annexation of Austria. And I was just like saying, this is going to be great. And it turned out that it was actually really great, and it could be really greater. So if you could just fill us in a little bit of the details, what happened after 1998?
Well, that's right. In 1998, Austria enacted a new law. I should give a little background. There was an exhibit in New York where two paintings by Egon Schiele were seized by the district attorney there, and it was asserted that they had been stolen from Jewish families, and the Austrians were sort of outraged. You know, we don't have any looted paintings. We gave them all back and that type of thing. And there was a journalist named Hubertus Czernin, an Austrian journalist, who dug into that and looked at the provenance of a lot of the famous paintings in the various museums in Vienna and realized, no, they still had a lot of looted paintings. They had paintings not only that had never been returned, but also paintings that had been returned after the war, sort of, to families, but then extorted away from those families in the post-war period. Austria used its export permit procedures to essentially require Jewish families to donate enormous amounts of valuable artwork to Austrian museums in order to get other property out of the country. And so he exposed all this, and the Austrians then enacted that law. Like you, I heard about that announcement, and I got a call from my grandmother's best friend, Maria Altman. My grandmother had passed away, but my mother had kept up with her. And so she contacted me and said, I heard about this new law. Could you help me? My family owned these magnificent paintings by Gustav Klimt. And at the time, I knew who Maria was. She was my grandmother's friend. I had even seen the paintings when I went to Vienna, because I remember as a kid, my mom pointing out, you see that picture on the wall? That's your grandmother's friend, Maria's aunt, Adele Blochbauer. And I remember the name because it was so long and difficult to pronounce. But I didn't know the history. I didn't even know that her family had owned it. I just know it was a portrait of her aunt. And so I met with Maria, and she told me the story of what had happened to her family and how they had managed to flee, how she and her husband had fled. And so that's how I got started. That was in 1998. The Austrians, unfortunately, after passing the law, weren't so interested in actually doing what they had said in the law. And so initially they turned down a request to return the paintings. And so I
let me interrupt you right there, Randy. Did they, as a gesture, say, okay, we made this law, so you rightful owners, you get to have these paintings back or these things back? Or they didn't do anything?
Well, in 1999, they had a commission that they set up. Imagine setting up a commission to decide whether to return property to Jews. But, of course, there were no Jews on the commission.
Of course.
And which is hard to believe, but true. And they decided not to return the Klimt paintings. They said those had been willed by Maria's aunt, Adela, in her will to the museum. But they did return some porcelain and drawings, which had been donated after the war in exchange for export permits. So they did get some things back, but not the most valuable things, which were the paintings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me ask you. Let's talk some theory over here. People are anxious to get all this stuff back, and it's the estimates of how much artwork the Nazis pilfered is anywhere between 100,000 to 250,000 different pieces, and some of this stuff could be like stuck in vaults someplace that nobody knows about today, even. And the rightful owners of this, these families, are gone, and there's nobody to even claim them. And a very vast majority of Jews, the family that I lost in the Holocaust, these people were all living in the shtetl. The most valuable thing they had was a cast iron teapot, and
right.
they didn't know from this kind of stuff. What about all's fair in law and love and war? And we took it, and now it's ours, and too bad on you. And we say, like, the Brits did it all over Egypt and throughout the Middle East, and they have Greek artifacts are in the British Museum, and the gates of Ishtar are in Berlin, and there's parts of Nimrod's wall is in the DIA. This is stuff that belongs to somebody else that somebody took from a war. Why is this stuff different?
Well, okay, so a few things. In terms of estimating the number of artworks, of course, it just depends on what you call an artwork, right? There were 6 million Jews killed, even more expropriated from, and everybody had keepsakes and things on their walls and valuables, even your family, and it just depends on what you define as an artwork. So it's really an arbitrary number, but it is true that there are many, many, even extremely valuable paintings that are still missing. For example, Maria Altman's brother-in-law, Bernard Altman, was a sweater manufacturer, had a very large art collection that was auctioned off by the Nazis 2 months after the Anschluss. And he had 4 Canaletto paintings. They're listed in the catalog made for that auction. 3 of them have not yet appeared, just to give you an idea, from a prominent Viennese collection. So if you extrapolate from that, it could be hundreds of thousands. Who knows? As for wealthy people had art and other people didn't, I think it's understandable that in the immediate aftermath of the war, people had other concerns besides artwork. Millions of people had been killed. Their lives had been destroyed. The survivors needed to sort of rebuild their lives, and reclaiming paintings was not number one on anybody's list. And so I think it's not surprising that these things have sort of waited for decades now to be dealt with. And then you come to the issue of, well, okay, it's such a long time ago and other people take art. That's not necessarily comparable. You're still talking about people like Maria Altman, who, when I was working with her, were still alive. These were family possessions. The portrait of her aunt that hung on her uncle's wall. So that, while we still have living people who grew up with these artworks and remember them, I think it's a different story than talking about the Elgin Marbles. And each case is different. If you look at some of the antiquities that are in museums, they were obtained not necessarily in the way that the Nazis ripped paintings off the walls from Jews. Someone was in charge, someone was paid. And they were taken away. And that's the case with the Elgin Marbles in Greece. And that's not what happened with the Bloch-Bauers, right? The Nazis came in, people fled for their lives, their taxes were levied against them, discriminatory taxes, and their property was liquidated if it was done that orderly. And And that's I think, a different situation. So I don't think you can really just sort of look at every artwork in every museum and say, well, okay, this happens all the time. And besides, you know, things have changed, fortunately, for the better since the end of World War II. We do have the rule of law in our country and other countries in Europe and elsewhere. And just because people haven't abided by those laws historically in the past doesn't mean we shouldn't abide by them now. And the rule in the United States is that a thief cannot convey good title, which what that means is once something's stolen, it remains stolen. It doesn't matter how many hands it passes through. Once it's discovered, it needs to be returned to its rightful owner, its mm-hmm. original owner.
That's rather Talmudic. It says in the Talmud that a thief from a thief is a thief. So indeed, yeah. If you're just tuning in, we are talking about we talk about the film A Lady in Gold, which depicts the return of the Klimt portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. We're with Randall Schoenberg, who is the attorney. You appeared before the Supreme Court and argued the case that there is a right to sue a foreign government like Austria because of a U.S. citizen having property that was confiscated by there. And you won the case, but you never actually sued Austria because the Austrians would not have recognized the jurisdiction, and it would have been a waste of time and effort and money. Was there anybody who took up your precedent and actually did sue a foreign country for return of an object?
Well, let me correct that a little bit. We of course did file a lawsuit against Austria, and that case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court on whether there was jurisdiction for a court to hear a case right. against a foreign country. After we were successful in that argument and established that there was jurisdiction, the Austrians offered to arbitrate the case in Austria, and I, much to everybody's surprise, agreed to do that. And
rather than suing them in America,
rather than continuing with the lawsuit in the United States. So it wasn't that we didn't sue them. We decided to adjudicate the case differently in Austria. There have been other cases filed against other foreign governments. There's a case pending against Spain in Los Angeles right now. The Cassirer family from Germany is seeking a Pissarro painting, and that is still pending. I know that the heirs of Kazimir Malevich also successfully filed a suit in Washington for the recovery of a bunch of paintings by Malevich.
They got their paintings back after this? They won their suits?
That was against Amsterdam. And, yeah, I think most of these cases end up settling and not going to trial. Mm-hmm. And you could look at our case in the same way. It was settled by arbitration rather than a trial in a courtroom. There, it's very difficult to try these cases. And, you know, to be fair, most cases don't actually go to a jury trial and get decided that way. It's a very small portion of all litigation really gets to that final judgment. You know, ours was close to that because we did it in an arbitration. It wasn't really a settlement. It was a winner-take-all arbitration. So we came close to having, you know, an actual trial in a U.S. courtroom. We just did it in Austria.
Mm-hmm. I suppose this was some sort of a precedent. I don't know if you're familiar with the Schneerson Library, which is being held in Moscow.
Yeah, very familiar with that case. I know some of the lawyers who were handling it for a while. That case also relied on our case as precedent.
Mm-hmm. And it, as we, my grandmother would say, garnished helfen, you know, so they sued, well, they won, well, and, you know.
The issue for us was similar. Austria is actually a neutral country, at least considers itself neutral. That means it doesn't enter into treaties with the United States to enforce judgments. And so that was one of the issues here, which was even if we had won the case, which could have taken many years. Maria was 89 years old at the time. Even if we had won in the United States, they could have ignored it. And that's what happened with the case for the Chabad Library in Russia, where they had a default judgment, and the Russians have just said, we don't care, we don't recognize it, and we're not going to return it. So you need to have some cooperation from the other country, whether it's by treaty or otherwise, through, like, we had an arbitration agreement that allowed the decision to be enforceable. So that hasn't happened yet in the Chabad case, but it's something that I worked to create in the case for Maria Altman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how about once Austria arbitrated the case and ruled in favor of Maria Altman and gave back the paintings, was there now a national admission of guilt and participation of the annexation, or are they still having like the ostrich in the sand complex and saying, no, we weren't there?
Well, it's complicated. If you see the film, there's sort of a speech that my character gives at the end saying there are two Austrias. And that's actually something that I wrote in the arbitration because it was my experience. There were people like Hubertus Czernin, the journalist, who really got it. He had ancestors who were Nazis. He also had some Jewish background, actually, if you dug deep. But he really was one who was very interested in confronting Austria's past and uncovering these secrets. There are still many in Austria who are not like that. So you can't really group everybody together in Austria and say they don't admit or they do admit. Different people do different things. And it is complicated with Austria because it's, yes, there's the sense here, sort of Austria was the first victim. That comes from the feeling of, you know, in a sense, it's true because the Jews in Austria were the first victims, and they were Austrians also, my family included, and Maria Altman's family. So Austrian Jews were certainly the first victims outside of Germany of the Nazis, and you see that very much in the film because they have very, very good recreations of a lot of the famous scenes from the Anschluss. Also, many Austrian anti-Nazis were victims of the Nazis. So the Chancellor of Austria, who was sort of a Austro-fascist dictator, Kurt Schuschnigg, he spent the entire Nazi period in a concentration camp in Sachsenhausen and was nearly killed at the end of the war. They had a famous train of people from Sachsenhausen. The order came to kill them, and they were able to convince the guards not to do it. So there are people like that. Many of the prominent people who were initially sent to Dachau after the Anschluss were not Jewish. So when they came back after the war, they, I think, rightly said, we were victims of Nazism. We spent 6 years in Dachau or 7 years in Sachsenhausen, that type of thing. And that was a very convenient cover then for the 98% of the rest of the Austrians who were enthusiastic supporters of the Nazis. So they sort of latched on to the few people in Austria who really were victims of the Nazis because they opposed Nazism and made that sort of their national claim. And that's what people object to today, that saying, okay, yes, there were Austrian victims, but Austrians overwhelmingly supported Hitler. And so they themselves were, you know, most of the people were not victims, but willing collaborators.
Mm-hmm. Keeping this painting, it was referred to this Blachbauer picture of Adele Blachbauer is referred to as the Mona Lisa of Austria. The idea of not giving it up, was it because of anti-Semitism? Was it because of a national treasury? Was it because the painting was worth a whole lot of money?
I think it was all of those. You know, imagine you set up a commission to decide what pictures to come back, and there were a couple state attorneys, but it was mainly art historians and political people. Their inclination was not to be generous, not to be careful, not to return, not to keep looted property. It was the opposite. Their tendency was, you know, let's make sure we don't give back anything that we should keep. And that's really the underlying problem that we have with a lot of restitution issues, which is from the Jewish perspective, we say, let's make sure that everybody gets their property back, even if some people get more than they deserve, if there's some fraudulent claims, that's okay, because the main concern is that everybody who should get their property back should get it back. The other side is, let's make sure only the most valid claims are approved, because we don't want to give back something that shouldn't be given back. And so their default is different than our default, and that's a shame. But that's what leads to these problems. So, you know, they looked at it and they found an excuse not to give it back, which was Maria's aunt, the woman in the picture, Adele Blachbauer, had left a will that they said gave the paintings to the museum. And in fact, She had asked her husband to give the paintings after his death to the museum, and the paintings were actually his property. So it was just a request to her husband and not considered binding at the time. Even when she died in 1925, there's a document from 1926 that says these requests aren't binding and the paintings belong to Ferdinand. But the Austrians didn't want to acknowledge that. They just wanted to focus on the words in the will saying, please give these paintings to the museum. They said, okay, well, she wanted them in the museum. That's good enough for us. We're going to keep them.
Mm-hmm. Was it going back, I'm starting to harp on the subject, but did the Austrian government ever say, yeah, we're sorry we took these paintings when they gave them back or any to anybody?
Yeah, no, we never got any sort of apology.
Mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, you beat us in court and here you go and we have to give it up. And
we'll be upstanding and acknowledge the judgment, and that's the way it has to be. But there was never any apology, and I even wrote something. The Austrian lawyer afterwards was not very happy with me, but I said, I don't see any honor in sort of fighting to the death against Holocaust victims and losing. I think if I were in their shoes, I would bend over backwards to make sure I wasn't on the wrong side, or there wasn't any chance I was on the wrong side. And it wasn't an overly easy case. There was this issue of the will and other complications, but they really saw it as their duty to oppose and make us prove, beyond a reasonable doubt that we deserve these paintings. And I think that's not an honorable position. And so I was a little critical of them, but I didn't get any apologies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Doctors have
the 8 years of trial that they put us through.
Understood. Yeah. Yes. Doctors have, I'm going to be a little glib now, that doctors have an expression, see one, do one, teach one. So now that you have won an art restitution case, this makes you, in the eyes of the world, an expert at art restitution cases. And I see actually that you are indeed a lecturer at UCLA. So I suppose that you are teaching
USC,
about USC.
USC, sorry.
Okay. And so therefore you are teaching about, I suppose, art restitution law. And so what's now for E. Randall Schoenberg, as far as what other things are on the horizon that you're trying to restore to its rightful owners, Randy?
Well, I do teach. I don't only teach about looted art, but I try to teach about all of art law, which they asked me to do, which is a challenge because I was not really an art lawyer, but more of a regular litigator. But that's really a small part of what I do. I still am involved in a few cases, and I also am president of the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust, which is the oldest Holocaust Museum collection in the country, and I helped them build a new building, and I actually was very involved in setting up the new permanent exhibit. So I've been very involved in that. And with regard to art restitution, there are a number of pending cases. I mentioned the one in Spain. I'm not involved in that at the moment, but I am helping represent a woman who's claiming two pictures by Lucas Cranach the Elder, an Adam and Eve diptych that if anybody's ever watched Desperate Housewives, in the opening credits, there's that Adam and Eve that sort of split apart. Those are the two paintings. They're in the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena, California, which is a very beautiful museum set up by Norton Simon, a Jewish industrialist who passed away many years ago. And these paintings have been hanging there for 30 years, and they were discovered about a decade ago by our client. And these paintings were taken from a Jewish family in Holland, a man named Jacques Houtsticker, who was an art dealer. The paintings were taken actually by Hermann Göring and recovered after the war by the Monuments Men, George Clooney and his merry band of men. The U.S. government recovered these in a salt mine and then sent them back to Holland. And the Dutch, like the Austrians after the war, were not very fair to surviving family members. Jacques Houtsticker had actually died in a shipboard accident fleeing Europe, but his widow and son tried to reclaim property, and they were given the cold shoulder. So they left a bunch of paintings there in Holland, and these two were then sold in the 1960s to a Count Stroganov, who wrongly claimed that they had been taken by the Bolsheviks from his family. But he bought them from the Dutch and then sold them to Norton Simon. That's why they're in the museum there. So these are 100% looted paintings that have never been returned. The Dutch, by the way, in 2006, shortly after the decision in the Altman case, decided to give back all of the other Hautsticker works that they have, about 200 other paintings. But so these two would have been given back in 2006, but they had sold them in the interim period, and they ended up at the Norton-Simon. The Norton-Simon Museum has been fighting the case for, I think it's 8 years now. It's already gone up twice to the Ninth Circuit on procedural issues, statute of limitations, whether it interferes with foreign policy, all of these crazy arguments. The museum's been losing every time. It's the same type of thing. The lawyers see it as their job to fight, rather than do the right thing. And the obvious right thing is to give back these paintings. I mean, there's no question. There's no defense on the merits. It's all about procedural issues.
Mm-hmm. So I would assume there's a difference in nuance in fighting a case of an American owning a looted American painting as opposed to, say, a foreign government owning a painting.
Right. You would think it'd be easier, but for some reason it isn't. And, some museums do the right thing. I think, we every few months or so there's an article about a museum discovering a looted painting, giving it back.
Yeah, we reported about Rutgers a couple of years back, the museum in Rutgers giving back artwork to the tune of many millions of dollars.
Right. So, there are many good people who look at these and say, we don't want stolen works on our walls. I helped an individual who had received a painting as a gift, a valuable painting, and then got a letter accusing him of having a stolen painting. And he was shocked. This painting had been in his living room for 30 years. And I helped him establish that, yes, it was this painting that had been stolen. And once we did that, he said, I don't want it anymore. I'm going to give it back. And that's a very honorable and right thing to do. Not everybody has that type of integrity, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. That's going to do it. Okay, we're going to wrap this up. Thank you. Our guest today has been E. Randall Schoenberg, who is the principal attorney for the return of the Klimt Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, which is the subject of a film, which is now in movie theaters called A Lady in Gold. We want to thank you so much, Mr. Schoenberg, for coming on. I have a glib question to ask you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You're the grandson of the famous composer Schoenberg, who invented the 12-tone compositions, which was absolutely wonderful. And also I found out that your maternal grandfather was also a composer, Edward Geisel. Are you musical?
it's like waves. They come at each other, and when they meet in the middle, it flatlines. I guess I'm a little musical, but I don't really have any talent. You're right. My mother's father is Eric Zeisel, Z-E-I-S-L, and my grandfather on my father's side is Arnold Schoenberg, and it's a great musical legacy. Both of them were, wonderful composers that are actually they both composed actually a lot of Jewish music, or at least Jewish theme music. Mm-hmm. And I've been mining their archives for concerts that we put on for our kids' bat and bar mitzvahs. We have one left, but we've done two full concerts of liturgical music
by
my grandfathers, and we'll have a third one coming up. So there's just a lot of music out there, and it's great for me to have that in my background and be able to explore that.
That's awesome. Okay, I want to thank you so much for coming on. I wish you continued success, and keep us apprised of further developments.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Time for a little a cappella music. This is AKA Pella Well, I like that name, A Cappella. Yeah, exactly. Yesh Tikva, it's a Benny Friedman cover. Let's listen to it.
שחור כי גם זה יעבור והכל יסתדר כי השם יעזור יש תקווה אם נשאיר כולנו יחד יש אמונה חזקה מכל הפחד לא ניפול, לא נירד כי אנחנו לא נבד יש לנו השם אחד יש תקווה אם נשאיר כולנו יחד יש אמונה
Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mycosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mycosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. Let's do, this is actually a niggin. A niggin is usually a song without words, which is more soulful as such. It doesn't have to be sad. It can be upbeat and lively. Listen, song can do that too. This is Barry Weber doing a Chabad niggin a cappella, and he calls it Chabad Cappella.
Yeah. Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park is something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Hey, Herschel Fidman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Shmini. We can actually say, for those people who study a portion of the daily, of the weekly portion daily, we can say finally, because this year, because of the way the calendar is set up with Passover, those people who study the weekly portion have actually been studying. This will be completing 3 weeks on the same portion. Now, there is an adage. When this situation comes up, so as not to get discouraged, the portion is Shmini, which means eight or eighth day. So the expression is Shmini Shmeina Shmeina. It's I guess you could call it a Hebrew pun, which would translate, and it loses everything in translation because it sounds really cool when you go Shmini Shmeina Shmeina, you know, so Shmini Shmeina Shmeina, that translate that when you read the portion of Shmini 8 times, because we read the portion of the Torah on the Sabbath afternoon, on Monday and Thursday, so it'll come out that we have read it 8 times. So Shmini, which is the portion, Shmoina, which is 8, Shmeina is fat. It'll be a very fat year. I mean, it's considered a very blessed year. The idea being that it's a good thing that we have to go over this portion again and again. And, of course, I have time since we had Chol HaMoed and I had some time off and I kind of had time to look into the portion. So I would say of all the portions of the week, I probably have been studied in-depth portion of Shmini probably the best. That and Bracha, which kind of happens the same day that there's situations where we'll be reading a portion of Zoysa Bracha for 21 days, 20 days, yes. So the same type of a deal because of the holiday there. So it should be a good year. Listen, I'll take any blessing I can get. Towards the end of the portion, it talks about, in fact, the last part of the portion, talks about kosher and non-kosher animals. This is where we know about animals having to have split hooves and chew their cud. Fish have to have fins and scales. And there's a list of 24 non-kosher birds. And it's discussed that why is it 24 birds are listed, whereas 4 non-kosher animals are listed, and is because we always list the list. So in the entire world, that there are over 700 species of bird, only 24 of them are not kosher. Basically, we have general principles that if the animal eats meat, like it either kills or eats carrion, dead animal, then we don't eat them. We like to eat our animals that eat our vegetable eaters, herbivores, as the case may be. And there have been various discussions over some types of birds, if they are indeed kosher. There was a discussion about turkey, for example, because turkeys were indigenous to North America, and they brought them back to Europe. People were going, huh? And the English were saying, oh, you could eat these things. And then people did. But there are people who objected to eating them. During World War II, it was discussed whether sparrow was kosher by the rabbinate in England, and they decided that it was, but nobody ever ate a sparrow because, believe it, it takes enough as the same amount of effort to process a sparrow as it does a turkey, so you might as well just process a turkey. You get a whole lot more out of it than a sparrow. But there's listed the 24 birds, and there's two birds that I'd like to focus on. One of them is the eagle, which is the first one which is mentioned of all the birds. It's called a nesher, which the word nesher means it molts. I may have said this in the last 19 years again, but it's worth repeating. What's the deal? This is a bird. It's the most majestic bird. If you ever see like an eagle flying overhead, you go up north, there's a bunch of eagles up there. There are eagles in Kensington, for those people who are listening local. There's, two pair of eagles that nest up there somewhere. Bird watchers have told me they have seen them. It's an awesome thing to suddenly look up and see. It's an eagle. And what do we say about the bird? We describe it as being a bird that loses its feathers as it grows. But hummingbirds do that. What's a great big deal? So we learn a lesson from the eagle that even something which is so great that people just stop and look at, there's always room for improvement. We can learn from the eagle. Yeah, you want to be great? Good. You want to soar higher than any other thing around? Wonderful. You want to carry your young on your back to protect it and put you first? Awesome. But you know what? You can always do better. And then there's another bird called a cormorant, which is a semi-aquatic bird. It has a long bill, and it does one of these, like, kamikaze dives into the water, and comes out with a fish. It says there's a verse in the book of Isaiah, I believe it is, that says that the cormorant judges the fish. Now, here it is. Everything is by divine providence. The Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, one of his tenets in Hasidic philosophy was that every blade of grass, every microorganism, is controlled by divine will. It's happening because that's the way God wants it to happen. And the verse in Isaiah leads us to understand this, that here it's not by any specific chance that this specific bird, this cormorant, happens to dive into the water and take out this specific fish. It's an act of divine providence. And if that's the way things are happening in nature all the time, as every single step is an act of divine will, how much more so the things that happen in our lives? Which leads us to understand we shouldn't get depressed, we shouldn't get angry. We should understand that the Almighty is in control of our lives. And because we are not in control of our lives, we've got to take a quick commercial break and be right back. Don't go away. We got the Hasidic story coming up. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Go to rabbifinman.com. You have a contact page. You contact me. I contact you. We become best buddies forever. Yep. There's also archived editions of the show. The Today Show will be posted sometime after 1 o'clock-ish or so by the time I get to it. It's got to be be able for me to upload it. All kinds of technical stuff that goes on that I don't understand, nor do I wish to bother you with. But it's after 1 o'clock. You can check it out over there. But we have the last 5 editions of the show still up there. We have archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, and the Hasidic U-Story, which are different media of yours truly, conveying Judaism in an entertaining and hopefully educational way, and the very important donations page. We are in the throes of April. It's April 12th. March? I'm sorry, we didn't. As with all the people that did help with the membership last month, that and I gave out more CDs as more people signed up for memberships at the Jewish Hour this year than ever before. Thank God that paid for April. So we would like to get it done that before the April 30th, 30 days has September, April, June, and November, before April 30th, we would like to pay off March and April. And we know we can do it. We've done it before, and we need your help. So go now to your computer. Go to rabbifinman.com. Click on the donations page. Click on a number of your choice. Add your own number. It doesn't make any difference. It's all very safe, secure. Divine blessing will be showered upon you because this is an act of charity. The government of the United States will like you as well because we are members of a 501(c) tax corporation, so you get the bonus of not having to pay so much taxes. So it's a win-win-win-win situation for everybody. It's a win for you. It's a win for us. It's a win for the listeners. It's a win for God. Everybody's happy. And how much did it take? Just a couple of bucks. So go to your computer. Don't like using your computer for money and transactions? I understand. Send your donation in any amount to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Back in 1962, there was a young rabbi who's not so young anymore, but he's still there. His name is Rabbi Shapsi Alperin. He's the head shliach, the head Chabad rabbi in Brazil. And he was just starting up shop, and he had a weekly lecture every Tuesday, which, being that he was just starting out, this is 1962, when people were kind of like still leery of identifying themselves in openly as Jews, believe it or not, 40 years or so after the Holocaust. So he had many non-Jews that actually came to his lectures, but they would come once or twice and see this wasn't for them. It was a curiosity, but there was one couple that came every week. They were not Jewish. And he asked them, so what attracts you to this class? They said, we have a daughter. Her name is Angela. She has a very serious tumor in her back, which is life-threatening. We understand that you have a connection with a rabbi in Bracha in Brooklyn who gives good blessings. Does he bless non-Jews as well? So Rabbi Alperin, and this is true, says a true leader cares about everyone. So he wrote a letter, but they didn't get an answer. A couple weeks went by. They went to visit their doctor, and they got the new report that the tumor went away. Miraculous. They were so happy. They said, please send and convey regards to the Rabbi, thanking him for our blessings. That was sometime around February. In July, so Rabbi Alperin traveled to New York to visit the Rebbe and was trying to get a private audience. But before he even had a private audience, the rabbi's secretary was looking for him and handed him a letter, what's up with the girl in Brazil with the tumor? And he said, oh, my goodness, I never told the Rebbe. And he wrote down the whole thing with the whole thing that happened and apologized for it. And when he went to Yechidus, the Rebbe said, people have to tell me good news as well. When he came back to Brazil, he told this non-Jewish couple that the Rebbe was inquiring about their daughter and was asking their welfare and sends regards. And they said, what day was it that you talked to the Rebbe about our daughter? He said, it was this Sunday, this and this Sunday. They said, that was our daughter's birthday. So, yeah, a true leader does care for all of his flock, everybody, not just one. That's going to do it for today. And thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.
Hi, folks. Alan Thicke here, and you've probably heard, maybe from me, that if you owe the IRS money, they can do some scary things. Garnish your wages, levy your bank account, even...